History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. There's one topic I'll always be able to go back to on this show in case I'm out of ideas, is the collapse of a civilization. Civilizations can die for any number of reasons, and I've done episodes on all these different ways. It can happen in one day as a result of a major military defeat, like what happened to the Byzantine Empire against the Ottomans on May 29th, 1453, although it can happen due to an environmental collapse or climate change, like what happened to Viking colonies in Greenland, where the weather became inhospitable and they had to leave to better pastures, or it can be due to an epidemic, like many American Indian societies when European settlers came, brought smallpox against which the natives had no immunity, and 70 to 90% of the people who lived there were completely wiped out. So arguably, all societies die. And some people have been talking about that with the United States, and whether or not it's on the decline is impossible to know from our vantage point, but in one way or another, every society must come to an end. I'm going to be talking about this topic of how societies die and how they can evolve and change and keep going over time with Samuel Cohn. He's the founder and first president of the American Sociological Association and also author of the new book, All Societies Die, How to Keep Hope Alive. He considers social decline and explosions of violence in a variety of historical and contemporary settings, including the Byzantine Empire, the French Revolution, and the present-day Middle East. So some of the things we're going to discuss on this episode include the circle of societal death, what it is, what causes it, and how it connects to other social collapses of the past, and how it helps us understand the root causes and avoidable issues, the triggers of social destruction, what we should be looking for and working to change in order to avoid societal collapse in the future, how crime, corruption, and violence have impacted the rise and fall of past societies, why big government is essential for both prosperity and for societal survival, and also, like I said earlier, how societies evolve and adapt. I mentioned the Byzantine Empire collapsed, but many of the aristocrats and nobles were able to find a future in the Ottoman Empire and serve as high-level functionaries in that government, and some historians and some Ottomans argue that the Ottoman Empire was in many ways the next step of evolution of the Byzantine Empire, and the Sultan himself called himself the Emperor of Rome. So maybe societies don't completely die, they just evolve and adapt with the times. So these are very high-level issues, issues that I'd love to discuss on this show, and I hope you enjoyed this episode with Samuel Cohn. Samuel, welcome to the show.
I'm glad to be here.
Well, it sounds like there is something to the people who are on the streets with sandwich boards that say the end is near. They might be wrong on a few things, but it sounds like in the grand sweeping scope of history, as your new book suggests, they're on to something, if I have that correct.
Well, first of all, there's no one out in sandwich boards saying that the end is near. Okay? I don't think I've ever seen one of those since I was a child watching cartoons. However, there are lots of people who talk about the end is near. The most common category is people who are concerned about ecological crisis. And of course, they've got some backup for this because the Earth is facing very, very real systemic survivability questions for the biosphere. I am not aware of any society that's ever died of immorality, and there never really has been any moral code associated with military weakness. For the people who say, you know, we're losing our moral standards, therefore we're going to be militarily weak. Have they seen the moral lives of football players? And football players would probably be pretty good in the field if they were fighting. So that's crazy. The ecological stuff I maintain in my book, so that does that, it gets included in the package. But people who only see ecological disaster are only focusing on a small piece of the problem. There are many societies for real that have died of ecological disaster. Greenland, which was once fertile and is now iced over, is the classic example of man-made destruction of an ecosystem and the society that went with it. Greenland was wiped out.
Mm-hmm.
However, ecological crisis is a lot like disease. Some you survive, some you don't. And a lot of it depends on what you do when you get the disease to fix the disease. Most ecological problems are soluble. One of the ecological problems that we've had mild ability to reduce, it's not covered yet, but the progress was made, was when people saw that population growth was about to overwhelm the resources of the planet. And people forget what a remarkable accomplishment it was to invent new forms of contraception and get effective forms of contraception to some 80 to 90% of the world. And so world fertility rates have been dropping like crazy, which is exactly what the Earth needs to survive. And humans intelligently adapted to that. Other ecological problems we faced, once upon a time, the Great Lakes looked like they were going to be polluted beyond any possible repair. And the United States and Canada got together to put in water control, pollution control measures, both on sewage systems and on heavy industry. Heavy industry was the worst contributor. And now factories that run in Ontario or Ohio or Michigan are significantly cleaner. They put much less into the lakes, and the lakes look like they're being rescued. So any societal death threat can be met, in theory.
Mm-hmm.
What matters is if people are working on the problem and they're cooperating with each other. In the Great Lakes case, the United States had to work with Canada, and both of them had to attempt some short-term economic sacrifices to make sure that their factories ran clean. They did that, and the lakes got cleaned up. On world population control, to some extent, the United States paid a lot of the bills on that. But this is a function of all sorts of international organizations working together to disseminate and make available effective contraception to the poor populations of the world. And essentially, nations work together in teams of like 90 to 150. Those materials were spread out with a wide variety of organizations, both governmental, civil, you know, transnational, local NGOs, local governments, local medical groups were very important in this. Lots and lots of doctors working together to help accomplish this. Often support from feminist groups or from groups concerned with economic development. It was a giant collective pull together, and it essentially worked. And both individual nations in the world have this capacity when they want to cooperate. When factional disputes are driving everyone apart, and no one wants to let the other side do anything for fear that they might win, then you start where there's lack of trust in government or lack of trust in international institutions. Once you stop cooperating with people, once you start insisting on your own little group, you lose that adaptive capacity. You can almost think about this in a Hollywood way. We know one of the oldest stupid tropes in action movies is like the cop and the bad guy who suddenly faced an external threat. Martians are invading, and the two of them get together, and for the last half hour, there's exciting action scenes of the cop and the robber fighting off the Martians. We've seen that movie a million times. Well, if the cop and the robber never get together, the Martians kill both of them. And kind of the threat that we're facing in the world now is a global reduction in cooperation. That means that we're not going to be able to cope with the next threat, which might even be environmental. It could be a lot of other things too, but the environmental threats are real unless we work together. So are the economic threats, so are the technological threats, so are the educational threats, so are the corruption threats, so are the crime threats. We have all sorts of threats coming our way. We work together, we solve them. We don't work together, we are an ex-civilization.
Well, I'd like to do something that academics always do at a seminar that at the beginning that bores most people, and that's define our terms. And the reason is because for your book, we're dealing with many cases, some stretch out over vast swaths of time from the ancient world up to the late Middle Ages with the fall of Byzantium and the conquest of Constantinople by the Ottoman Empire up to the 19th, 20th century, 21st century, and challenges that are faced by a modern industrial society with industrial pollution have some similarities, but also categorical differences with those that are faced in the ancient world. So I had a whole episode if listeners want to hear on societies wiped out by ecological collapse all the way back to ancient Assyria due to over-irrigation and water shortages that resulted from that. So what would you define? What is society and what is collapse?
All right. What is society that gets us over? Collapse is the more fundamental question, because collapse, realistically, just like if you get a bad diagnosis from the doctor, your first question to the doctor is, what does this mean if I have this disease? And that's a very real question that a patient wants to ask. On society, I'm very careful about the definitional game, because there are so many different definitions, and they draw you away from the main question and the main threats. You can keep academics arguing terms all day. For those people who want to kill the book right now and say, I'm sick of this podcast, I want to put out a baseball game. If you define society as a civilization, a set of ideas, a set of cultural institutions, those last far after the societies that created those civilizations have gone. So we talk about the fall of Rome. In terms of Roman civilization, Rome never fell. And for that matter, neither did ancient Greece, of Greece of the Athens, Sparta, 500 BC glory years period. Never mind, we still read the Iliad and the Odyssey. Our courthouses all have pillars. We use a whole ton of the language. We are still heavily driven by a lot of the philosophical foundations laid out by Aristotle. Plato, not so much. Aristotle, quite a bit. And so in very real ways, and it's not hard to trace the lineage of Roman architecture, Roman technology, Roman culture, through Arab traditions, where it was kept more alive, and then later on revived in Renaissance traditions, and traced it all the way through to the present day, including much of the way that we formulate our laws. So if you're worried about our civilization, even if America's in ashes and we're in a post-nuclear war, which is not what I think is going to happen, but still American ideals will continue and the last remaining music that they're listening to could still be Elvis Presley.
Mm-hmm.
More fundamentally, though, you could talk about a nation, a nation's fall. Some people talk about, if you will, a regime, so that the nation is still there, but there's a fundamental change in government social system. So, for instance, when the Tsar fell in Russia and was replaced by communists, which to some extent actually GDP went up after that, so it was not really strictly a fall. But certainly when the communist revolution occurred, every institution in Russia was eliminated and replaced with something else. That said, the most common kind of fall, and the one I'm worried about, is not the kind of the revolutionary change or the civilization change, a dramatic reduction in economic growth, leading to a period of widespread poverty where there had once been well-being, generally accompanied by a collapse in the size of state units, a collapse in the effectiveness of state units, and with it, a dramatic drop in personal security. Crime rules, piracy rules, in some cases, warfare rules. So if we look at the fall of Rome, in some ways, and some historians have found various positive features, that the world was still kind of a good place after Rome fell, particularly if you were being persecuted by, you know, the Romans were kind of mafiosi. They would take people for sex slaves. They would take people for gladiators. They would make all these crushing demands on all the people around them. So a lot of Germans were just as happy to see Rome out of there. But concretely, what happened net of the difficulties of the relationships with the Roman Empire, because the Roman Empire could be obnoxious, standards of living collapsed. And we know this because it's what archaeologists can do if they can measure how much material stuff is around for different periods. And you see houses and farms, not only of rich people and rich villas, but poor regular farmers, where they've got a third to a half of the stuff they used to have. At the same time, warfare became dominant throughout Europe. All sorts of raids and violence were possible. The Romans' main function was to keep piracy out of the Mediterranean and brigands off the road. Now travel was not safe, and because travel was not safe, long-term trade collapsed. With long-term trade collapsed, economic standards of living collapsed. What also failed was a technological fail. Learning collapsed. Literacy became primarily the domain of the Catholic Church, and the monasteries had their own literary traditions, and they were scholars, and they kept things going. Engineering and science capacity completely collapsed. Romans could build roads that lasted. Many of those Roman roads are still there today and functional. Romans built aqueducts that could beautifully lay out water from Switzerland to the city of Rome, with the water always flowing downhill. All of that capacity was lost. And if you look at the buildings that were built in 700, 800, 1,000, they're crude little towers, such as you might get on a barbarian scheme. And you look at the great architecture of the late Middle Ages, often which they're doing things that the Romans knew how to build. They didn't regain this building capacity for about 800 years. Such things as astronomy, math, those were largely lost. They were maintained in the Arab world, because remember, Arab world had the Library of Alexandria, and for a long time they were keeping that Roman technology going. So if you went to the cities of like Alexandria, they had sewage systems. They had gas lighting. They used Roman technology to build their roads. So they still had the tech, but Europe did not. So when you think about a fall, this does not mean 1,000 dead bodies everywhere in post-nuclear ash, although obviously there's a nuclear war, that's what you're looking at. Life goes on, even in the face of the famous falls. When Chinese dynasties fell, there was a Warring States period. And life went on during the Warring States period, but people were poorer. They were under the threat of crime. There was warfare. And if you wanted to think about what modern education was shot, technology was shot, nothing worked. And one way that you can think about what a civilization world would look like in 2100 or 2200, 2300, whatever it falls, is a miserable parody of modern industrial society where things don't work and nobody's safe.
Mm-hmm. I think that's the resonance that dystopian fiction has today, because there's a fear that this pattern of social collapse could be triggered. So as a way to deal with that existential fear, then authors are writing what may have happened just to explore that. And I think to see how some of the fears of modern society play out. And your point's well taken too, of if we talk about the intellectual contributions of a civilization, in one sense, that won't die. And some of the elites or cadres can move on. With the example of Byzantium, many of the aristocrats and elites join the Ottoman Empire. Some convert to Islam. Some don't even bother to convert. They just keep their land holdings and work as administrators and go onward. I'd like to return to some other points here. Well, actually, first of all, before I get to this, I want to touch on some of the other topics in your book.
Sure.
One term you use is the circle of societal death, something that can connect different social collapses together. So can you describe that process? Is it, at what point is it unavoidable? Is it irreversible at some point?
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
It can be fixed if people take action to fix this stuff. That's it. What the circle of societal death is the process by which societies die. An easy way to think about it is that if you look at all the things that occurred that allowed the world to get better and better and better and better and better from 1350 to the present day, and what it is you run all of that in reverse. Almost like, you know, camera stuff, you run the movie backwards. It literally is putting a knot in front of everything that we've had for the last 700 years. Let's describe what history has looked like since, if you will, the early flourishes of economic activity that occurred in northern Italy and in the lowlands in the 1300s. A combination of economic growth, rising trade, scientific and technological development, growing state capacity instead of little tiny micro warlords who can't keep things together, either city-states or the prototypes of nation-states, who are building more, who are doing it, who are, you know, in those days, economic development didn't mean laying digital internet. In those days, internet, when the state produced economic development, it drained fields. You took produce, or in the case of the Netherlands, built dikes. But doing things that would create a certain amount of economic growth, institute law and order, get rid of brigandage in their territories so that trade became safe, be a patron of the arts, or often patron, in some cases patron of religion, because that's what got things through, so that slowly but surely personal safety, state effectiveness, and standards of living are improving. Note that when standards of living goes up, mortality goes down, because people aren't hungry, they're better fed, they live longer, they get sick less. And what happened was that that process continued. States got bigger and bigger. They were able to take on more functions. What the American government does and all the problems that it solves in 2021 are a hell of a lot more impressive than what a doge in Venice would have been thinking about in the 14 or 1500s. Economic planning, ecological planning. Yes, we also are patrons of the arts, patrons of science, builders of roads, all this crazy, incredibly sophisticated judicial systems, far more complex than those that would have existed in Renaissance Italy that can resolve a far larger range of conflicts. And so all of this stuff leads, and also one thing that people don't quite take into account, corruption goes down. So that the governments in Italy, or even Holland not so much, but certainly Italy, were corrupt as hell. And even to the 19th century, even the United States, we have a long history of government corruption. But things spontaneously clean up as the governance process gets better and better. So people have more faith in the government. Rising selection of technocrats into governance, who are people who have to be good to their job, as opposed to you're the son of someone you're in. Rising inclusiveness, and this is another feature, the system of cooperation gets bigger and bigger. Not only were states become bigger and bigger, the United States is far larger than the city of Venice. Not only are states bigger and bigger, and each government represents a system of cooperation, but international cooperation is bigger. Let's think about just a couple of common sense things. The internet is a giant system of international cooperation that most people participate in and like. Capitalism, even with all of its flaws, and I can talk about all of its flaws as long as you like, it is still the most effective form of wealth generation ever devised. It is an international system. No one country can stop it. And people largely participate in it happily of their own free will. They enter the labor market, they enter the goods market, which has been, you know, the force producing all this increase in GDP per capita and standards of living. It's pretty powerful. Cultural convention, never mind the fact that people all like to watch similar movies. Often they come from the United States, but kung fu movies came from Hong Kong, okay, or China. Sharing of food, sharing of medical techniques, often Western techniques, but acupuncture's come back the other way. Giant sharing of knowledge and technology that allows everyone to be able to function better. So we are at one of the highest levels of scientific development, not only in the hard sciences, but in many, 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 many forms of human endeavor that comes from this elaborate interchange of information and interchange of cooperative relationships. Even something as simple as tourism, and oh, tourism, that's tacky. But that represents gigantic international income flows as people go all over the world to eat each other's food and do each other's see the beautiful things in each other's country, learn a little bit about the other person. Except for going to Mecca or the occasional trip to a religious shrine, that almost never really happened in 1350.
Mm-hmm.
And so this giant system, we take for granted the fact that I can listen right now to Jamaican reggae, or I can listen to all sorts of new hip-hop coming from Africa, or I can listen to K-pop, and people do, not to mention overseas, them listening to a lot of the Americans. So this giant cultural interchange is incredibly rich and powerful. Now, this is that growth process of increased, and I'm going to use the concept, this is a key concept here, increasing size of networks of cooperation.
Mm-hmm.
A growingly large number of people over an increasingly large amount of space are collaborating with each other. And that is the essence of what made all of the growth occur from 1350 to the present day, is increasing webs of cooperation. Now, what the circle of societal death is about, it's this 12 different processes whose net effect is to shrink the web of cooperation, to make groups turn against each other. My family first. I'm not paying taxes. I don't want those people here. And in the process of pulling back support from working with other people, and I can walk through the precise mechanisms that won't sound good in the shorthand I've got here. You can easily link this to less world trade. You can easily link this to less growth. You can easily link this to warfare. This is not my quote, but it's a key quote. It comes from a guy named Gregory Hooks. War is development in reverse. You're smashing everything. And instead of cooperating with people, you're killing them. So I know that sounds very 1970s hippy-dippy. But in fact, just if you think about most, when you think about societal falls, usually the last act is a war, such as the fall of Rome for the third time, the fall of Constantinople. But in fact, war is also fairly devastating because people have to stay home. War is devastating because all of these crops got burnt and they spread salt throughout the land. If you look at such, Somalia tends not to grow. Somalia is one of the most warlike places on the planet, usually civil conflicts between particular groups that don't always show up on your newspaper, but these are all very real kinds of problems. And so, and what happens is that once I'm no longer, so to take isolated pieces of the 12-step model, reading you a 12-step model on a podcast is going to put all your audience to sleep, so we're not going to inflict that on, but to give you highlights. Well, if I'm not cooperating with the world, and I'm a public official, and you're my friend, I don't mind slipping you some bucks. I don't mind if these qualified people don't get in because you're in my group. You're mine, right? I don't care if we completely fork them over. If this is us, right? And so there's this sense of, and then of course, once you know that all your government officials are corrupt and are stealing like crazy, why the hell would you want to pay any taxes? And if you don't want to pay any taxes, how is the government going to do the stuff it has to do? So the things that, in the 1950s, the things we used to do, like build all these highways and do all this exciting stuff, you don't have the cash to do this. And the officials you have, since the money is often not in government, but the money is in other things, you don't have good people in there, and they're stealing like crazy. So government just doesn't work. When government just doesn't work, the things that government does to save the economy just don't happen. So if they just don't happen, there's less trade and there's less government help with the economy gets sicker and sicker. And as people are poorer, they get more desperate. And as they're poorer, they get more angry. And as they're poorer, they start looking for someone to blame. And politicians who can't get anything done blame them, and let's have a fight against them. Let's get this group out of our population or that group out of our population, or whatever it is. So you're now destroying more and more, kicking everyone out. You oppose any educational system that doesn't totally validate your group. So instead of everyone learning about the skills they need to improve things together, they're in teeny tiny little schools about why my group is great and the other group is the source of all evil. And forget math and science in that system. And so it leads to a general all-purpose takedown. So the 12-step model of societal death shows how all of these factors, crime works in a big way, because once you and I are just in it for ourselves, we don't care who we rip off. It could be just business crime, you and I just sell shoddy merchandise, or it can actually be downright violent crime. You and I, we're making sure we're taking this territory for us. We're getting them out.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
So to explore this idea further about networks of cooperation that can mitigate against social collapse. So there's, I think people could just pull out this or that example, but because you're working on such a large framework, I want to explore this concept, not just nitpick. So let's say, for example, what if there is, and you mentioned some of the criteria, there's cooperation, there's institutions that are trusted by the public, there's not excessive graft. What if there is cooperation and there's institutional agreement, but it's in the wrong direction? So for example, the conventional wisdom among political scientists before World War I is that building up resources would come by setting up colonies. So you extract resources from a colony. The idea of getting necessary resources just from global trade like we have in the 21st century wasn't really believed then. So it's part of what pushed German high command to World War I, thinking, well, we need to grow German colonies, we need to acquire land, or it's simply we're going to lose in the great game that's going on here. And this idea in the militaristic society of World War I was largely believed. So there was cooperation, there was, you know, belief in elite consensus, but it still led Germany to a devastating path. So what would you say I'm missing based on your thesis?
Okay. There's a million different social units that people can agree with and can cooperate in. The bigger the social unit, the more effective. So I'll take all the levels. You can have an individual. A dyad, that's a pair, is more effective than an individual. So it sounds, you'll see where I'm going with this in a second. Follow my road here. You know, so we know that single people die more frequently. If they marry, they both live longer because one person takes care of the other. They pool income. This all increases the better survival. A family is more effective than a dyad. What I'm going to call a tribe, and by this I refer to nothing African or First Nations, Ivy Leaguers are a tribe. Computer engineers are a tribe. Whites are a tribe. There's a million tribes. But these groups of people with some kind of cultural affinity, a tribe is more effective than a family. A nation is more effective than a tribe, and a global system of cooperation is more effective than a nation. At each level, there's the tension that each level, while in outperforming the groups underneath it, is going to fight with the groups above it. So the example you gave, Germany fighting the world, while at the same time what Germany did, both in World War I and World War II, both with the military industrialization that came out of Bismarck, and then later on a formula that was repeated with great effectiveness in the great 1930s by Adolf Hitler before he actually started the war, was using this kind of militarist ideal of nation, you know, which Richard Wagner wrote about as the great Germany, although he saw that as being failed morally. But building the great Germany to higher heights where they achieved higher levels of economic growth than they'd ever achieved before. Well, that's cool. A welfare state that was remarkably effective long before America was giving Social Security. They were ensuring the well-beings of their poorer citizens. Well, that's cool. Advancing one of the most sophisticated sets of universities and scientific institutions the world had. Germany and the United States were the leaders in world technology. And all of this was done under a militarist framework that produced some good. Obviously, the problem was that they engaged in a war that got them reduced to ashes in 1945. And no one would particularly like the results of World War I, which, of course, left them living with reparations and all the problems of paying that off. And we all know how destructive World War I was. And on World War II, we don't talk about it with the same sense of loss we do World War I, but I'll remind you of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and how much was destroyed just from those two bombs alone. So a conflict orientation builds you up from the smaller groups you had before. Remember, Germany used to be a set of very disunited little microstates. They were combined in 1870, and getting those microstates to work together, German nationalism was designed as the way to solve the problem of getting Prussia and Bavaria and Saxony to work together. And as such, it did that job well. But on the other side, there were some seeds of what Germany should have done more of, but did some of. Germany did engage in world trade significantly, notably in Central Europe, but it became part of a network of economic relations larger than itself. Through Switzerland, and it had its trade relationships elsewhere. It was significant in international diplomacy, often solving some common problems together. And if you take a look at post-1945, first West Germany and then now Germany has done a lot of the constructive working in the world community, economic trade, finance, helping to form a European Union. That was all very constructive. As units go up and up, there always will be some tensions of a pair fighting with its family. Think about Harry and Meghan. That's a classic family fight that's just in all the tabloids. But it gives the example of we form a union together, but unfortunately we're fighting with the group immediately above us. Or God knows we had American Civil War, right? Two halves of the country fighting each other, one of the most brutal, bloody combats that ever existed to this time. So it's very common that the cooperative process produces conflicts with upper groups as the way, but you want to get past that as much as possible and move more towards the pattern of global cooperation. And in general, through a lot of histories, a lot of the history of, say, 1350 to the present day, that global cooperation really has been augmenting in various ways. Often, and I talk about in this book, the seeds of the destruction are based in the nastiness from which that process occurs. And think about the colonialization process. Think of the slave system. Think of the African diaspora. Think of the horrors of what Belgium did to the Belgian Congo. And when you create that legacy, you create a strong motivation for the colonized to not want to play this game anymore. You get this famous, and this is a common process, the cooperative process, a double-edged sword of a good news, bad news joke. The colonial experience ultimately raised the well-being of many, many nations. There were positive features of colonialism that don't get put in the record book. An elimination of crime, elimination of piracy, often bringing in educational institutions that were useful. Some of the economic development was helpful, but at a huge humanistic cost and often with crass exploitation. So the presence of the nice part doesn't eliminate the presence of the evil part. And that is very often true anytime there's cooperation. There's a double-faced aspect of this. Cooperation with negative aspects, which is the rule rather than the exception, creates the seeds of the destruction of the cooperative relationship. And when we talk about how all societies die, often the problems that you're getting are paying the past bills from ancient negative forces that were set forward because of these conflicts, conflicts that are unresolved, and even cynically, conflicts that are the ills are still being reproduced today.
Thank you for doing the overview, and there's a lot of other huge meta-historical things to unpack. For readers who want to check out more, can you tell them the name of your book and where can they find it?
All right. The book is All Societies Die, How to Keep Hope Alive. It is Cornell University Press. Cornell will be happy to sell you a copy if you go to the Cornell University Press website, but it's available on it. Basically, now that we have a coronavirus, no one's going to bookstores anymore.
All right. Well, appreciate it, Samuel. Thank you for joining us.
All right. That is all for today's episode. As a first order of business, I need to thank the Knowlton's Rangers, and I'll explain what that is in a second. And they are Kristen Lee, Willie from New Jersey, Suma 41, Sergeant Hooch, Wire Meets Wood Guitars at WMWGuitars.com, Bill Ivey, Tom from Ohio, Salvador Sanchez, Dane Carlson from Linwood, Washington, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael Piccinetti, Michael from New York, Jeff Mitchell, owner of Mountain West Commercial Las Vegas, Josh Reddick, Jake Harrington, Josh from BFW Post 2285, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraser. Now, if you'd like to support History Unplugged and help it grow, there are three easy ways to do so. First, subscribe to the show and leave a review on the podcast player of your choice. This helps other people discover the show. Second, join our Facebook group, and here you can discuss recent episodes with fellow listeners, mention what you'd like to see on the show in the future, and get way more out of the show, and just look for History Unplugged on Facebook. Third, become a member of the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were an elite reconnaissance and espionage detachment of the Continental Army established by George Washington, but it's also the membership group of History Unplugged, and here you can really dive in way deeper with the show. You can check it out by going to Patreon, patreon.com/unplugged. If you join at the Scout level, you get early access to new podcast episodes, and you get completely ad-free versions of the entire back catalog of more than 500 episodes. Plus, everything is neatly categorized, so if you want to listen to something about the Middle Ages and skip all the Civil War stuff or vice versa, you can easily find an old episode from 3 years ago that, if you're just looking on Apple Podcasts, would be buried in the feed. If you join at the Intelligence Officer level, you get all the same stuff, but access to a growing catalog of now more than 60 premium episodes that come out bi-weekly, including a multi-part series on the life of Audie Murphy, the most decorated combat soldier in World War II, a series on French Foreign Legion fighters in World War I, one on Teddy Roosevelt's years in the Dakota Badlands, and a series on Nazi attempts to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Lastly, if you join the Spymaster level, you get all the same stuff as level 1 and 2, but you also get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You can choose a historical topic on absolutely anything, and I'll base an hour-long episode on it. Plus, you get a 3-pack of hardcover books. So again, check it all out by going to patreon.com/unplug. Well, that's all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and see you next time.